first question for you out there. Who are you?
The label that I use to identify myself most is
Irish and Scottish.
Older, working class, poor.
And I consider myself a gun-owning capitalist hippie.
I identify as working class.
I am an American Muslim woman.
Puerto Rican.
I'm a black man, plain and simple.
I'm about as white as can be.
A gay man.
I consider myself to be pansexual.
Liberal.
Jewish.
Broke.
White.
Environmentalist.
Female.
Buddhist.
Liberal.
Working class.
Black.
Democrat. And business owner.
American.
Crazy cat lady.
Number one mom.
The only label I actually use is artist.
I'm an American. It don't matter what race I am or any of us are.
In 100 years, I hope we all have just one label. Human.
Ah, the United States of America. Land of the free, home of the brave, and lots and lots and lots of opinions on what it means to actually be an American. So, who am I? I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. I want to welcome you, our listeners, to this daily national conversation. I've spent my career reporting on issues that matter to Americans, everything from how technology shapes the way we communicate to racial injustice and economic inequality. And today, I come to you as the host of a show that we hope will represent different points of view from different parts of the country, not just New York. At some point today, this broadcast will be heard in places like Williston, North Dakota, and San Angelo, Texas, and Jackson, Mississippi. And while the things that matter to you, to your families, to your communities, in many ways may be different, there are also many commonalities. You see, it's all part of this 241-year-long experiment that we're part of called the United States of America. It's an experiment in democracy, an experiment in identity, and it's an experiment in what it means to be free in a place that you call home. Quick history check here. At the founding of this country, being an American, or at least one who had rights, essentially meant being a white guy who owned property. Today, though, that identity is shifting fast, from what we look like, to where we worship, to who we love. And so it's not surprising that for many Americans, those changes create a sense of anxiety. Some people feel they'll be left behind by the country they thought they knew, and others are excited to chart a new course, to take part in that dream that so many of us aspire to. And if you think this is all pie-in-the-sky talk, it's not. Americans really think about this stuff. 2017 data from the Pew Research Center found that 36% of American adults reported that their family had, in fact, already achieved the American dream. 46% said they were on their way to achieving it. Throughout the week, we'll spend some time examining the different facets of American identity, from who we think we are when we talk about the working class and the elite, to the way religion and politics influence our identities. And at the end of today's hour, I'll talk with President Jimmy Carter, who says his faith has defined most of his life. So stick around for that conversation. But to help us kick things off, I'm joined by three people with very different identities. We have Amy Walter, the national editor of the Cook Political Report, Sarah Smarsh, a Kansas-based journalist covering socioeconomic class and author of the forthcoming book Heartland, and Michael Eric Dyson from Georgetown University. His latest book is Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Great to have you all here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
All right, Amy, so I want to start with you. Is there such a thing as a collective American identity?
I think that there is a collective sense for what that means when you say that I'm an American. But I think what has changed, especially in the last, let's say, 20, 25 years, is that we're hearing voices from different Americans. So I think there was an image of what an American looks like, sounds like, acts like that had been sort of put into our culture thanks to movies and, you know, popular music, et cetera. And as we have transformed as a society, especially as technology has helped to transform us, we're now seeing different Americans and their Americanness that looks different from the image that we once had.
Michael?
Yeah, I think that's true. Look, there's been a huge and fractious division between those who want to see America as predominantly white and therefore an invisible identity. Many white people are not encouraged to think of themselves as white. So the problem right off the bat is that many white Americans don't conceive of themselves as one among many ethnicities, one among many identities. They see themselves as deraced, that whiteness is a default position, therefore it's invisible, that their American identity is something that everybody should aspire to. So why don't you black people stop it? Why don't you brown people stop it? Red, yellow, all of these other rainbow colors, stop it. Just be American. Why hyphenate yourselves? The great philosopher Beyoncé Knowles said recently that it's been said that racism is so American that when we protest racism, some assume we are protesting America. So, yeah, what's interesting here is that, you know, we have this notion of what it means to be an American, and the world sees it in rather more simplistic terms sometimes than we do. And at the same time, from within, we've always known that there were cantankerous differences, radically dissimilar identities that we were attempting to subsume under the rubric of America. And yet we want a right to define what that America is.
Sarah, I'm curious to hear from you in response to Michael's comments about whiteness per se, because you are from a place that many would say that's white America, right?
Yeah, and I think actually, so I'm from Kansas, which like many agricultural states and largely rural states is losing population overall. But in Kansas, the Hispanic population in particular, as of the last census, had grown by 60% in the past decade. So that shift in color, in culture, in all sorts of identity markers is happening on the ground there. And pretty infamously now, as the rifts that are revealed there have been exposed in kind of the wake of the 2016 election, rural America is overwhelmingly white. However, there are, let's say, Garden City, Kansas, which is out in the western rural expanse of the state. It's a meatpacking town, and it's incredibly diverse. I believe it's a white minority place. Since the 70s, it's been diversifying with an immigrant population, and that happens to be a town that has, you know, no doubt racism is and white supremacy is at work in the systems of that place, but the community has found a way to embrace its diversification in such a way that it is one of the few counties that's actually gaining in population. And so they're kind of realizing, not by any, you know, standard of moral character necessarily, but just the economic imperative of like, we're going to have to be cool with this or else this place is going to die. So
is that right? Because I feel like the perception and the media reporting around that has been the opposite. It's been the quote unquote white working class really being threatened by brown workers or black workers.
Yeah. I mean, my experience of growing up among the white working class and quote unquote under the poverty line, my dad's a construction worker. I grew up doing agricultural labor. I'm a fifth generation farmer. Something I always like to point out when there is this like fixation on the quote unquote white working class in national media is white people at every income level voted for Donald Trump at the same rate. So what I like to say is whiteness elected Donald Trump, not poor whiteness. So just like we're talking about no place is a monolith, the white working class isn't either.
Can I go back to raise an idea? We keep talking about America as an aspiration and an idea. And I think that's what we saw in the 2016 campaign. But quite frankly, it's been clashing up against, these two ideas have been clashing up against each other for quite some time. And that's this idea of, you know, the American dream and the American aspiration, and this is, we aren't a thing, we're an idea. And the clash now is between what we had, right? This is what America was. America was great when, versus the traditional America aspiration. We still can be this, right? Whenever we have a tipping point like we're in right now, and it's not just socially and culturally, but how technology has changed our lives, how the economy has changed. It feels like every 15 minutes there's some big disruption to our lives. The desire to go back to what we had versus, oh no, things are going to be better over on the other side. And of course, if you are in the group that things were good for you 50 years ago versus things weren't that great for you if you were alive 50 years ago, you're going to have a very different concept when you ask the question about what it means to be American and what it means to have the American dream.
And I wonder if y'all can sort of address this issue too. The American dream is, I think, in many ways being unmasked as a sort of myth. It's one of the narratives that we as Americans have been fed. Work really hard, quote unquote, this is a meritocracy, you'll get where you want to get, you know, you can get the house, the picket fence, et cetera. And I think at least the last decade or two have shown us that that is not necessarily true, and it's increasingly difficult for people to even think about getting into this middle-class house with the white picket fence. And I think there is a certain amount of disillusionment, if you will, among Americans about that. We do have some research, however. And in 2016, Pew Research Center data found that the American public describe certain characteristics, and they rated them in terms of their importance of what it means to be, quote-unquote, truly American. Does anyone have any ideas before I tell you what the first couple were?
I'm going to guess that one of their answers was shaped by capitalism, maybe.
Employed.
Yeah, right.
Employed helps. Michael, any ideas?
Yeah, maybe employment, maybe where you live, you know, rural versus urban, or, you know, what you feel about how did you vote in the last election, whether you're Democrat or Republican? I don't know. I mean,
well, I'll tell you, the one that was ranked with the highest importance was being able to speak English.
Right.
The second highest was sharing American customs and traditions. Third was being born in the United States. And fourth was being a Christian.
Wow. Yeah, well, yeah, I think people of color have always understood that the American dream was a fantasy and an ideal. Poor and working class white people have often understood that as well. And I think we have to pay attention to the fact that none of these groups are homogenous. There are, you know, deeply religiously conservative black people and brown people who adhere to their religion, who believe in America, apple pie and the flag. And the irony is that many Republicans on the far right don't understand what a vote-rich and morals-rich community they have in both black and brown, among many others, communities, if they would just knock off some of the racist approaches through the politics and public policy, they could exploit an enormously fertile vein of moral and religious conservatism that almost happens, quote, naturally in these communities. And I'll end by saying this. So when we talk about the white working class, I think the admonition to see that they are not homogenous is extremely important here, because the white working class has been used as a poster boy for good stuff and a whipping boy for bad stuff from the very beginning. Race and class become intertwined so that the racism of the white working class, the homophobia of the black and brown working class, and some of the tensions, the sexism of all of them, means that these are complicated communities. But when we come down to trying to figure out, oh, who's a good guy and who's a bad guy, it's really more complicated than us versus them.
Guys, I want to make sure we get to some calls from listeners that really stood out to us over the last week. Take a listen to this.
Hey, this is Charles in Louisville, Kentucky. If I identify as white, I'm a racist. If I identify as male, I'm a sexist. If I identify as Christian, I'm a bigot. So I identify as working class, because it's not okay to hate the working class, at least not yet.
Amy, your reaction.
Yeah, I think he represents this idea that I was talking about earlier, which was it was pretty clear 50 years ago when you were any one of those categories what that meant. And now as we are having more of these voices into the mix, voices that are challenging what it means to be all of those things, I am not surprised to hear that there is a bitterness and a wariness, and also a feeling that the ground is shifting constantly beneath me. We hear this a lot with the Me Too movement. At the same time, I think what we are recognizing is that this is going to be messy. The more that we involve different points of view in different people, it's going to challenge all of us to reassess what it means to be whoever it is you are. And voila,
yeah,
here we are, 2018.
Right. I think that's an extremely valuable insight there. The problem is the caller ain't mad at the structures, though, right? He's not mad at the fact that, hey, there's an inequitable distribution of resources, influence, wealth, opportunity. Ultimately, I think what's interesting here is that many people who've been forced to play fair in the sandlot of life don't want to share their toys. That, yes, this has thrown everybody off. The Me Too movement has thrown everybody off. The desire for racial and political justice has thrown people off. But being thrown off, then, that's the predicate for at least changing society in a fundamental fashion. And it is messy. Democracy is messy. Fascism is always neater. Democracy is far more complicated, and because it allows whosoever will to get into the fray. And I think that's the beauty, that's the beautiful mess of American democracy.
Yeah, to Michael's point about kind of the irony of the caller's comment. I actually disagree with him that it's still not okay to hate the working class. I mean, I think that of all colors, this is a country that is just venomous toward people who have not, quote unquote, pulled themselves up and succeeded in, you know, a capitalist framework.
I want to go to another call, if we could, and take a listen.
Hi, this is Savita from Greenville, South Carolina. As a non-white, non-Christian, able-bodied, educated woman, multiplicity and intersectionality have shaped my identity. I am many things, some self-described and others described by others. My identities overlap and can be deployed differently. When someone calls me American, I add that I'm also Indian, for example. I am both privileged and also an object of discrimination.
Amy, your thoughts on that?
I do think that is representative. It could be of all colors, right? How do you identify versus how does somebody identify you? When you walk into a room, what's the first thing people think of you? Do they look at your shoes and they think, that person doesn't really have a lot of money? Do they look at the color of your skin? Do they look at how well you're dressed? All of those things are happening to you constantly. And it is this feeling we have, again, this is the beauty of America, which is this thing of, I'm going to identify myself. Nobody can do it for me, right? And yet we know that's not how it works. You are going to be put into those different buckets. I think the bigger challenge we have right now is that it's easier to caricature someone than it is to understand them.
But it ain't equal, is it? Isn't it?
That's right.
Right. We don't want to understand black people, right? The point you're making now so brilliantly, we say, well, wait a minute. It's easier to caricature than to understand. Where was that when we needed that?
That's right.
But I think that, to go back to that call, the one solution that we can turn toward is pushing ourselves as a society to hold simultaneous truths. So I grew up pulling rye out of wheat fields with my hands in an almost entirely white place where I perceived myself to be at the bottom of a pecking order because it was a place where whiteness was not only the illusion of some sort of American default, but it was also physically what I saw when I looked around. And it felt to me like that I didn't have much economic privilege. I then, you know, as I move through the course of my life and understand the ways that whiteness has benefited me, it turns out that yes, you can have racial privilege and be economically disenfranchised to some extent simultaneously. And of course, these kind of simultaneous truths are realities for every individual American in different ways. And I think that our media narratives tend to, you know, we color states red and blue. The brain's impulse to categorize in succinct ways says this person is this and this person is that. It is more complex than that. And I think the only way forward is to find that humanity, not just to Michael's point, as some sort of empathy for the white working class, but for everyone.
Sarah Smarsh is a Kansas-based journalist covering socioeconomic class and author of the forthcoming book Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Eric Dyson is a professor of sociology at Georgetown University and author of Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Thanks, Michael.
No, I'm grateful very much for this conversation. Thank all of you for participating, and thanks for inviting me.
And Amy Walter is national editor of the Cook Political Report. But, Amy, we have some big news, don't we?
We do.
Tell us a little bit about what's coming, what we can expect.
Well, I'm very excited about this. Tanzina, this is not the only time we get to be on air.
That's
now,
right.
Not always at the same time.
That's right.
But starting June 1st, every Friday, I will be hosting The Takeaway. And in it, we're going to try to do exactly what this conversation was getting to, which is dig deep into some of the political and policy issues that are impacting all of us. I feel like we're at a time now with incredible disruption all around us every minute. Our phones are buzzing constantly with breaking news alerts. We have more information than ever, but we don't always feel very informed.
We don't.
So this
sadly
is the opportunity to really try to get an understanding of what this issue is, how did we get here, where do we go from here, bring really smart, insightful people to
you, the listener.
This is fantastic, and I know if you enjoyed this conversation, this roundtable, and you loved hearing from Amy, well, you're going to be able to hear from her every Friday coming up, starting June 1st, talking about politics here on The Takeaway, and we're so excited to have this collaboration with you, Amy.
I cannot wait to get started, and so happy for you to be starting and getting this journey on the road.
Let's do this.
Let's do it.
All week long, we'll be talking about identity here at The Takeaway, and I really want to hear from you on this. How do y'all identify? Do you use or reject labels like the ones we've been hearing from our calls? Tweet me at Tanzina Vega, and we might include some of your comments in our show later this week. And coming up, I get to talk with a former president. Pretty exciting. And then later, an update on the war in Yemen and America's role in that ongoing conflict. Back in a minute.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Yeah, Tanzina?
Yes.
I'm glad to be with you this morning.
I am so honored to have you talk to us today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
Now, Jimmy Carter needs no real introduction. He was president from 1977 to 1981, and before that, governor of Georgia, a proud peanut farmer, and a constant advocate for human rights. But at his core, and central to everything he's done throughout his life, President Carter is a man of faith. And that's the subject of his new book, Faith, A Journey for All. And the book comes at an interesting moment in this country when I don't think it's a stretch to say that many Americans are suffering a crisis of faith in our system of government, our institutions, our elected leaders. But are these problems really new?
Well, a lot of these problems long preceded the election last year. For instance, when I left the White House, we had one person in 1,000 who were in prison. We now have 7.5 times as many people in prison as we did just that short time ago. We've had a horrible disparity in income. We've had a similar problem with discrimination against women in our country. In fact, we just had to struggle for a long time just to get women the right to vote. And when we finally got the 20th Amendment passed back in 1919 or whatever it was, that just gave white women the right to vote. It didn't give African-American women the right to vote. That didn't come until a good bit later. And most of the problems, like racial disparity and animus or animosity sometimes between white and black people and preferential treatment and imprisonment, those things have long preceded the 2016 election. But I think a lot of that disparity and difficulty and high publicity to these differences has been exacerbated in the last year or two. That's certainly true.
And it's hard, I would imagine, you know, to tell. I mean, I'm a Latina. I grew up in public housing. Like, I know people who've been incarcerated. I mean, there are a lot. It's a hard sell for poor people in this country, for Black Americans in this country, for Brown Americans to feel confident right now in our democracy. I think regardless of what side of the political spectrum you're on, if you feel like you cannot engage in society without your life being threatened in many instances.
Well, you know, I grew up in a house that didn't have running water or electricity, and I also lived in a government housing project when I first got out of the Navy for a long time. I didn't have any money at all. And so I know that feeling, but I think there are of the people, even before the 2016 election, were feeling that they were left out. They didn't get a fair shake from government. And it was not only Latinos and African Americans and so forth, but it was also just the average working family didn't feel that they were getting a fair shake. And for the first time in our history, the last few years, our young people have not believed that they're going to have a better chance in life than their parents did. That's a new thing for America, but it preceded the 2016 election even. It was on a trend before that. So I think now is a time for us to take the advice that my school teacher used to give me, and that is we must cling to or welcome changing times but adhere to principles that never change, like integrity and truth and freedom and things that that give us a moral and ethical guidance in life. And collectively, Americans will decide through the choice of leaders that we make, what can we do to correct these problems? That's what America's history has been. Whenever we've had a horrible prospect in the past, we've overcome those problems with our resilience and so forth. I think the United States has the ability to do that again.
And you mentioned moral responsibility. I want to ask you about how and what a president's moral responsibility is to the American people and how faith shapes that responsibility or doesn't shape that responsibility.
Well, after I was elected and before I was inaugurated president, I got a briefing from our military leaders and I was informed, which I really didn't understand previously, that I had the capability with more than 15,000 nuclear weapons, and President Brezhnev in Russia had in Soviet Union had the same thing, to launch a nuclear war which would have ended the life of every living thing on Earth. So this was, you know, the overwhelming responsibility that I shared. And I prayed more for guidance and for rationality and for understanding potential enemies and for how to get along with them when I was in the White House than I have any other 4 years of my life.
President Carter, no interview these days would be complete without a visit to our Twitter audience. And so we asked them yesterday if they had any questions for you. We got a ton of responses, and I've handpicked a couple of them. So the first question is from @TheFreedomSuite. He says, I read that Rosalynn Carter was instrumental in keeping the Camp David Accord negotiations from falling apart, a facet of the history that doesn't seem to be widely known. Can you detail what role she played and how she managed to do so? #QuestionsForCarter.
Well, Rosalynn was at Camp David almost all the time, and she was my, and always has been in every case, my main advisor. So when I had a serious problem with Begin or with President Sadat of Egypt, I would consult with Rosalynn, and she was always a stabilizing factor, not only in my life, but also she would, you know, work very closely with, say, Prime Minister Begin's wife, who I'm sure had a lot of influence on her husband, too. So Rosalynn was a nice, stable person. She was also the one, several weeks before we got to Camp David, who recommended that we go there, since it was a quiet and secluded place. So it was Rosalynn's idea that we even go to Camp David in the first place.
@LCThePM asks, what about America and Americans that he could not have foreseen during his term gives President Carter the greatest hope for our nation's future?
I think the resilience of Americans and the ability of Americans collectively to be wise in addressing major problems. We've had some major confrontations in America down through history for more than 150 years, just based on that one principle, all human beings equal to one another. We went to war in the war between the states back in the 1860s about whether black people could be slaves or not. We decided no, whether or not women were equal to men in the right to vote in a democracy. And we finally, after a long period of struggle, changed the Constitution to permit women to have the right to vote. We've been able to overcome these challenges in the past. And so we've been able in the past, Americans have, with our innovative spirit and our diversity of population, our basic constitutional principles to do the right thing. And I don't have any doubt that in the future, America will overcome our challenges as we have in the past, and we'll have faith in one another and faith in our principles that never change.
My conversation there with President Jimmy Carter. His new book is called Faith, A Journey for All. One more story for you today, but before we get to it, I need a little something from you. It's my first day hosting The Takeaway, and I need your help to spread the word. If you like our show, leave us a review and tell us what you think. It definitely helps others to find the show, and then they can tell their friends who can tell their friends, and you get it. And with that, let's keep going. Last month, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres declared Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. As the country enters its fourth year of war, more than 22 million people, that's three-quarters of the population, are in need of humanitarian aid and protection. 18 million people don't have enough to eat. The war there is often described as Saudi-led, but increasingly, we're learning of American military involvement.
We are authorized to help the Saudis defend their border. We have done that. We are doing that through intelligence sharing, through logistics support, and through military advice that we provide to them. We are principally focused on the ballistic missile threat and the maritime threat.
In March, at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, General Joseph Votel, head of that U.S. Central Command, described the United States' role to Senator Tom Cotton.
Is it fair to characterize that as a primarily defensive operation in nature?
Principally defensive and it is designed to, again, protect Saudi Arabia.
But that official line may have to change now. Last week, the New York Times reported that at least a dozen American Green Berets have been on the ground in Saudi Arabia to assist in the conflict. Eric Schmidt of the New York Times uncovered this. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Eric, what do we know about what the Green Berets are actually doing on the ground in Yemen?
Well, starting about last December, the Green Berets responded to a request from the Saudi Crown Prince, who was very concerned about these ballistic missiles that were suddenly raining in on his country, as you referred to. So the Pentagon very quietly sent about a dozen of these Army Special Forces to the border with Saudi Arabia and Yemen to work with their Saudi counterparts to help them defend this border, but also to work with American spy planes, surveillance planes overhead that were brought in to help track where these missiles were launching from and also where the missiles may have been stored so they could pass on that information to the Saudi Air Force for them to attack those sites.
And do we have any details on how many Green Berets there are, where they're exactly stationed, and how many perhaps we can expect going forward?
Yes, there are about a dozen, which is a standard for this particular team, and they're down in a city called Najran, which is right near the border. There's a military base there that the Saudis have been using. And the U.S. has been there, again, since last December or so, working with their Saudi counterparts and, again, setting up what they call an intelligence fusion center. That is a center where you have the Green Berets and some other intelligence analysts who can help basically assess the data that's coming in from these ballistic missile launches, as General Votel referred to, try and help locate them and then target them. And they're trying to help the Saudis do this as best they can. The Saudis have air defenses, Patriot missile systems, but those have worked only spottily, really, in terms of knocking down these missiles, over 100 of which have been fired at Saudi Arabia from Yemen in the last 3 years, accelerating just in the last several months. So the threat is quite real for the Saudis.
Now, is this consistent with what the U.S. government has said so far about the United States' involvement in the Saudi-led war in Yemen?
Well, if you listen to General Votel, you know, he's very carefully worded his phrasing to the senator there. He's talked about how the U.S. assistance is to help Saudi defend their borders. And then he went on to talk about, logistics, intelligence sharing. What the Pentagon has not been upfront about is the fact that there are boots on the ground. Now, granted, it's a dozen or so, which is much smaller than, for instance, where you see in currently in Iraq or Syria, something like that. But nonetheless, these are troops that are quite close to the Yemen border. And this is a city where they're operating from that has suffered from missile and rocket attacks. So they're definitely in a riskier position than I think what the Pentagon has let on. And certainly they haven't talked about the notion that there are any troops, even a limited number of troops, down that close to the border, particularly in harm's way.
Now, again, we go back to the fact that the UN is calling what's happening in Yemen the worst man-made humanitarian crisis of our time. Given this increasingly close relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, how much should the United States be held accountable for this humanitarian crisis?
Well, this has been an increasing focus in Congress, which is becoming increasingly critical of the Saudis and the Saudi role in this crisis. You had in this same hearing, General Votel was pressed by a number of senators to the fact that the U.S. is providing most of the refueling for these Saudi aircraft and Emirati aircraft that are conducting these attacks, allowing them basically to stay aloft longer. The U.S. says, well, that will help them, increase their targeting proficiency and their accuracy. But we still see still a number of attacks on civilian targets, including marketplaces and all. And so the criticism from Congress has been, wait a minute, if the U.S. is refueling these aircraft, they're complicit in these attacks. It's a criticism the U.S. has pushed back on. In fact, General Botell has said the U.S. really doesn't have any idea where these aircraft are going or what they're targeting, which raises a whole other set of questions, if you think about it, that we're refueling these jets without really any accountability on the other end of what they're doing.
And it's interesting because, you know, one of the talking points going into this administration was that we were pretty much going to stay out of a lot of these conflicts. I want to step back for a second and ask you whether this is an example, to that point, of the United States being involved in conflicts that they aren't necessarily being transparent about with the American public. What does that mean for us, for our national and or international security?
Well, I think you're right. We've seen, obviously, the president been quite conflicted on, say, the U.S. presence in Syria. But whether it's special operations forces in places like Somalia or Libya or West Africa, the country of Niger, where four American soldiers were killed in an ambush last October, these are increasingly places we're calling shadow wars, where the U.S. has relatively small numbers of troops, not talking tens or hundreds of thousands like we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan. But this is something the president and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis have supported, working with local troops in these kind of countries to combat largely extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, but often without a lot of publicity, without the kind of transparency I think most Americans want to know about, and oftentimes with murky authorities in terms of just what is allowing these troops to remain on the ground fighting a very elusive enemy in some cases.
And I was just going to ask you that, like, if these are quote-unquote shadow wars, how much not only does the American public know about them, but how much oversight are they under at this point?
Well, the Armed Services Committees are responsible in the Senate and House for such things. There have not been very many hearings about this. I think we'll probably see hearings after the Pentagon releases its report on the ambush in Niger, which could come as early as this week. So I think it's certainly in the case of lawmakers, you have many who are seeking to have greater transparency in terms of where American forces are operating, against what kind of enemy, and what is the long-term goal, and what is the long-term objective of these missions.
Eric Schmidt, reporter for The New York Times, covering terrorism and national security issues. Eric, thanks for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Wow. Thanks to everyone for being with me today for my very first podcast version of The Takeaway. Go review us, please. And just because this podcast is over doesn't mean I want the conversation to end. No. You can find me on Twitter. It's where I share a lot of my thoughts on the news of the day and where I'll do my best to interact with you directly. You can tweet me at Tanzina Vega. And thanks so much for listening on my first day. More tomorrow. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.